Let's play word association. If I say the term development aid, I bet you're not thinking like this.
Inside the White House Monday, discussions with U.S. President Barack Obama went forward on a new 10-year deal for the U.S. to arm Israel.
The U.S. is boosting its military assistance to the Philippines with $50 million set to be provided in aid, along with more Navy vessels.
That's Moscow confirmed today its military advisors are on the ground in Syria.
Our country has long been supplying arms and military equipment to Syria in accordance with bilateral contracts.
Military assistance as development aid? Not what comes readily to mind? Well, why should it? Except for the fact that the nature of foreign aid is changing, and the reclassification of military personnel and weapons as development tools is now a reality. That's our starting point today. Welcome to Future Tense. But we'll also look at other changes in the aid sector, particularly around delivery and philosophy.
For most of the last 50 years in the development space, we've been giving people what we as donors, sometimes halfway across the world, thought a family most needed. But when you think about a family living on less than $2 a day, how do we know what they most need? And so what the evidence has shown is actually when you give cash to these families that are living often on less than $2 a day, they know better than we do what their highest priorities are and spend it quite wisely.
Development aid delivered directly to the poor via their mobile phone. The group Give Directly, and we'll hear more from them shortly. But let's first return to that issue of definition.
Now, it's certainly my sense that the member states are going to be reluctant to open.
Just a few weeks ago, the head of the UN Development Programme, Helen Clark, made public her concerns about a recent change to the way in which foreign aid is categorised and what it might mean for the future. It got very little media coverage, but in February, a subcommittee of the OECD, the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, a club of some of the richest countries in the world, well, they met to discuss what should count as foreign aid. And that subgroup, the Development Assistance Committee, decided to significantly relax the definition for development assistance to include more security costs and also the money donor countries spend on dealing with refugees within their borders. Now, the argument in favour of such a change is that in order to build a safe environment for development work, you have to also invest resources in security. But that argument doesn't wash with Helen Clark at the UN or with the coalition of aid organisations which has condemned the change. One of those organisations is Oxfam, and Nicole Biskey is the humanitarian advocacy lead for its Australian branch.
So they've included things like preventing violent extremism, money spent on that, money spent on engaging with the police beyond just training, and training of partner country military personnel. So they've actually drawn the borders much more broadly than were previously the case in relation to what can be considered to be aid. Now, many of these things are important, as you've said, in the sense of training military on human rights standards, on rule of law. They're very important work and they absolutely need to be done. But the concern that Oxfam would have and that other organisations have expressed is that they should not be funded through the aid budget.
And is the concern that this is a slippery slope, that more and more of those funds that are set aside for aid will be diverted across to these other priorities?
That's exactly right. So as we increasingly see this money diverted into these different areas, areas of work that have previously been funded from other places, what that means is that there is less money meant for the most vulnerable and marginalised people around the world, the people for whom aid really is essential for their day-to-day lives, and they're not able to get the money and to get the assistance that they were previously able to get.
And again, you and others are also worried about this trend toward countries using their overseas aid budgets to cover the costs of hosting refugees or to pay for their domestic security policies around refugees. Why is that necessarily a problem when we're talking about people who are in need and we're talking about often crisis situations?
Under the current rules, they're allowed to use the first 12 months of costs associated with refugees being in their own country and to count that as aid. The concern that we have, though, is that the amounts of money that are being used are really significant. So to give you some examples, the Netherlands spent 27% of its aid on refugees last year. Sweden, in fact, spent 30%. And what that means is the Swedish Migration Agency is actually the largest beneficiary of aid funds now within Sweden. So the concern, again, in terms of what that money is meant for, it's meant to be aid. It's meant to be development money. It's meant to be spent helping people in really difficult situations. What we've seen at the same time is a decrease in the aid that's actually going to least developed countries and to people who really need significant assistance. So the money's being spent within rich countries like Sweden on services that should be provided anyway, education, health, housing, and that should not need to be funded out of the aid budget and certainly not to the extent that they are funding it currently.
And there is an important distinction to be made between development aid and humanitarian aid, isn't there? I mean, humanitarian aid is aid that helps people in times of crisis, but development aid is meant to build capacity within poor communities and poor countries, isn't it?
That's right. And development aid also needs to be long term. It needs to be an investment in the long term for people's lives to be improved over a significant period of time. It invests in programs like health, access to water, health and sanitation. These are not things that you can do quickly. These are not things that you can do as short-term programs to really ensure that you have impact and effect. And so when we have countries moving their aid budgets around and moving their expenditure around in this way, it also really jeopardises the ability to make sure that we're achieving positive change over an extended period of time in people's lives.
So the fear is it that we may not be dealing at the root of instability in some of these countries, and that by cutting back on the amount of money we're spending on development aid, we may in fact be helping to create future problems, or at least not stemming future problems?
I think it's a pretty simple kind of question in a lot of ways. When you have less money to spend on developing the real fundamental needs within the society, because you're spending it on other things, you're spending it on working with the military, or you're spending it on preventing extremism, and you're not spending it on the really basic services that people need, what you're actually doing then is not assisting people in developing their lives and really getting themselves out of poverty in the way that aid is supposed to really do.
Is the central issue here, though, the fact that the amount of money that's being pledged for development around the world has actually levelled off in the last couple of years, that perhaps the pot itself isn't big enough, and therefore these competing needs are having to deal with, in an environment where there is much less money to spend? Is that the main problem?
What we're seeing is a situation around the world where there's really significant need. And in terms of humanitarian need, the UN called last year for its largest ever humanitarian appeal for the second year in a row. So the year before had also been its largest ever at that time humanitarian appeal. So the needs are significant and are growing. And while we do have aid levels that are quite high in some places, when they're being increasingly diverted off to some of these other areas, as we've talked about, and in fact, when they're being spent within their own countries on domestic refugee costs, then that reduces the pot that is available to meet really significant and growing need.
Nicole Biskey from Oxfam Australia. Now, another person concerned about the future of aid is Dr. Max Kelly, a senior lecturer in international and community development at Deakin University in Victoria. She's one of the co-authors, along with Professor Victor Jakopek, of a recent study of trends in the sector, appropriately called Assessing the Impact of Foreign Aid. This is a crucial time of change for development and humanitarian aid, Dr. Kelly argues, and she says many aid providers have, over time, lost sight of what the real focus of aid should be. What's important, she says, is having a clear understanding of the difference between impact and outcomes. Max Kelly.
It's important to make that distinction because you can have outcomes that have no long-lasting or significant change in people's lives, their livelihoods, or their human development. So what we're looking for in impact is we're looking for both the positive or negative changes as a result of a development intervention, but we're also looking for intended or unintended consequences. For example, if you're looking at building a classroom or training teachers, an outcome may be that 50% of the teachers are using a better designed curriculum and you have better classrooms and more facilities. But the impact will be whether the retention rate of students is increased increased, whether their employability is increased. So that's the difference between a long-term significant change from development funding and a short-term measurable outcome, which may look good on paper, but isn't really what we're trying to achieve in terms of systemic change in development.
And a surprising outcome from your research is that many of our aid organisations, whether they're multilateral aid development providers like the World Bank or whether they're national aid programs, that they aren't really interested in measuring impact at all. They are much more interested in measuring outcomes, and that in fact they don't want to measure impact. Just explain that to us. Why would that be the case?
There's a couple of reasons. The first one is it's much easier to measure something quantitatively. There's this notion of the obsessive measurement disorder. So the more we can quantify something, the easier it is to measure, the more likely we are to do it. So an outcome can be easier to measure, but it can also be easier to say, well, we have achieved these things. We have so many teachers who are better qualified and using better resources. And that's a nice, easy kind of win. We can show nice pictures of children sitting at school desks, you know, with new books and the teachers. What we want to know, though, is the long-term impact of that on those children. And that's a much more amorphous concept to measure. It's more difficult to measure. But also, if, for example, your project or program doesn't show a positive impact or an impact that can be attributable to the work that you've done, that's a politically very difficult situation in terms of seeking further funding.
So politics is getting in the way here, is it, of our aid delivery? We've got to a situation where it's becoming more about the statistics and the photo opportunities than it is about the actual achievement of long-term results. Is that correct?
I think it's always been about the photo opportunities. I mean, the public want a kind of a clear, compelling narrative built around a picture of why aid works. And that comes back to accountability to the taxpayer. Now, as a development organisation, your accountability is often to the donor. So whether that be the bilateral donors or whether that be the Asian Development Bank, that's often where your accountability lies. Whereas the accountability should theoretically be to the beneficiaries. I'm not saying that aid doesn't work. What I'm saying is we need better proof of when aid does work and where it works and how it works well. So you need to actually conduct that impact assessment. You need to do that research. You then need to publicise it. So you need the skills and experience to do the impact assessment. You need to actually apply the funding to do this impact assessment. And then you need to use the lessons learned from that to ensure that your aid is being as effective as possible.
Now, you argue, don't you, that we are at a bit of a crossroads at the moment with regard to development assistance. Just talk to us about that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's been some really significant changes over the past couple of years. And I think two of those changes that are of particular relevance to our argument are in terms of new players in the development environment. And the non-traditional donors are called the BRICS donors, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa. So that's one grouping which is really starting to impact on development funding, particularly China. And then there has been the setup of two new institutions or development banks. One is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and that's driven by China. And that really has some strong implications for development in terms of its approach to development funding. Now, it's focused on infrastructure investment in the Asian region, and I think it really will provide competition for the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank, particularly in two areas. It is likely that it will have much less strings attached in terms of conditions attached to aid funding. And the second one is in terms of the actual standards and safeguards that are built into these larger infrastructure projects. Reduced standards can be really problematic in a development context because there's been plenty of understanding of the negative impacts, for example, of large dam projects in terms of displacing populations, people losing their livelihoods, road projects, air pollution. So there is just an enormously list of externalities or negative impacts of these projects which may not be covered as effectively with this new model of development funding.
So there might be some challenges in terms of, as you say, the standards and the approach that might be taken by these new players, but their arrival on the scene, is that a good thing? I mean, wouldn't that increase the opportunities for development assistance around the world?
Yeah, absolutely, because one of the core parts of the aid effectiveness agenda is around country ownership of development policy and practice. And if you have wider options in terms of where you source your development funding from, then it gives you more control over the process. You know, if you're choosing to go with an institution that does come with less strings attached, such as the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, that is going to really challenge the likes of the Asian Development Bank, which is much more along the lines of the International Monetary Fund kind of philosophical approach, and does come with conditionalities. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out over the next couple of years, seeing as it's come online now. It hasn't actually, the first loans haven't gone out the door yet, but they will be doing so very shortly.
And as you say, not just the approach might be different, but also the philosophical underpinnings.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a move from the so-called Washington Consensus, which, depending on how you define it, is really that sort of neoliberal economic model, privatising services, minimal government intervention and so on, to the so-called post-Washington Consensus. So a softening of this sort of really strong economic approach. So I think the new players will challenge that, because one of the things that China has really put out there in terms of why they're putting in these new institutions is that they really strongly felt that the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank and so on were really strongly too embedded in Western economic and philosophical and intellectual traditions.
Well, Max Kelly from International and Community Development at Deakin University, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Thank you.
By giving the gift of a dollar this holiday season, you can put it directly into the hands of those that need it most, so they can use it on what they need most, like food, shelter, clothing.
For most of the last 50 years in the development space, we've been giving people what we as donors, sometimes halfway across the world, thought a family most needed. But when you think about a family living on less than $2 a day, how do we know what they most need? Are we sending corn to a family that really needs healthcare? Are we sending schooling and training to a family that more than anything else really needs a roof over their house?
And it's those type of questions and a dissatisfaction, dare I say, distrust of traditional aid delivery programs and mechanisms that led to the establishment of GiveDirectly, a US-based aid agency that breaks the mold by making cash donations of usually around $1,000 directly to the very poor in Kenya and Uganda. Ian Basson is the organisation's chief operating officer, domestic.
There's an incredible dignity to giving people cash. It says that we respect beneficiaries to choose what they most need. It essentially says that we don't think that poor people are poor because there's something deficient about them. We think they're poor because they lack money, and that's what we're going to provide them. So we start by looking at what are the most impoverished areas, the countries in which we operate, in Kenya and Uganda. So we'll identify villages that have concentrations of poverty. And then when you go to a village, we want to determine a way of targeting the poorest families that is going to be very easy for us to administer and identify. You don't want a complicated process of applications and means testing and paperwork. If you do that, you lose a lot of the benefit of having a really efficient way of delivering aid to these impoverished families. So you want something that's going to be easy to operate. You want something that's going to be auditable so that we'll be able to make sure that we're actually getting it to the right people pretty easily. You want it to be something you can explain to the village so that everybody understands in a very transparent way why one family was given a cash transfer perhaps and another wasn't, because that one family is poorer. And then the last thing is you want a way of making sure that it's not easy to game, that people can't somehow trick you into thinking that they're eligible and they're not. What we give are cash transfers to these extremely poor families, no strings attached. That kind of raises a lot of people's eyebrows. The first thing people ask is, aren't they going to spend it on alcohol or cigarettes? Well, the research says, actually, no. World Bank survey of studies showed that if anything, giving unconditional cash transfers to the poorest people in the world actually has a negative impact on people's usage of what they call vice spending, say alcohol or tobacco. That's also not surprising. If I told you that I was going to be giving a gift certificate to my mother for her birthday next week, I doubt you'd ask me, but wait a minute, Ian, isn't she going to spend it on booze? That would be an odd question to ask. And why? Because we don't assume that people are going to do that, but somehow we do with very poor poor families. And that's actually kind of the reverse of what is the reality, because the truth is their needs are much more acute. If they get the kind of windfall that we're providing, they're going to be much more likely to spend it on things like a roof, things like food, things like school fees or healthcare, than they are to spend it on something like alcohol or tobacco. We make sure that the funds go to what these poor families think that they most need. And by and large, they make pretty good judgments about what they most need.
Give Directly has been operating since 2008. They claim that around 93% of every dollar donated goes to a needy recipient, and according to Ian Basson, they've directly helped more than 25,000 families. In the United States, Give Directly has been a bit of a celebrity case for an organisation focused on finding a better way to deliver aid, the aid delivery mechanism of the future. But there are sceptics. In 2014, the organisation's approach was criticised in the Stanford Social Innovation Review for the unconditional nature of the loans it gives, with the common sense argument that people actually do often make very bad personal choices in their lives, and the poor are just as likely to make a bad call as anyone else. The authors of the review article also doubted the long-term impact of direct donations. In other words, could giving a one-off $1,000 donation to a person really lift them out of long-term poverty? Or does it just alleviate the effects of poverty for a short period of time? And Ian Basson's response?
Almost every dollar that we transfer is part of an academic study. So the first program that we ran in Kenya, we had researchers from Princeton University come in and study the beneficiaries in the program, not just when we were transferring cash to these beneficiaries over the course of about 8 months, but also for more than a year afterwards to see what the impact was. And the results were incredibly impressive. The beneficiaries showed about a 30% increase in earnings after the transfer period had ended. They showed about a 50% increase in assets. So we saw very positive impacts on the first study we did, and now we're turning to answer new questions in the policymaking space through our transfers, such as what is the macroeconomic impact of giving a transfer of about $1,000 over 8 months to multiple families in a village? What does that do to the job market? What does it do to prices? What does it do to decision-making over public spending? The evidence for cash as an effective means of anti-poverty intervention is already quite strong. It's one of the most well-researched interventions out there, in part because we really didn't have a lot of research on what development interventions worked through the first 50 or so years post-World War II that we were doing, that the world was doing this type of development work. It's only in the last 10 to 15 years that people have started doing what we call randomized controlled trials, right? These are the kind of trials that people do on a new pharmaceutical drug, where they give it to a certain population, they don't give it to another similar population and see what the difference in outcomes is. They started doing that on development work about 10 to 15 years ago, and cash transfers are one of the best researched forms of intervention that show really effective results. There are only three studies that show a long-term positive impact on poverty. Two of those studies involve the use of cash transfers as an anti-poverty technique. So I would say the evidence is already strong, and what we are trying to do is continue to learn beyond that about other ways of potentially using cash transfers, perhaps, say, in a humanitarian setting after a disaster. Would it be effective to deliver cash transfers to refugees living in humanitarian camps to reduce the length of time in the camp? Because now they might have the capital on the front end to get out rather than staying in the camp long term.
Ian Basson from the not-for-profit organisation Give Directly. And just to reinforce the point, their approach to aid delivery is still a work in progress, but one that's got a lot of people interested, including economist and researcher Natalia Rigol from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Natalia and her colleagues have been working on a project in India to try and develop a better way for financial institutions and lenders in very poor countries to essentially do the sort of credit checking they need to do to make a loan. You and I might take mechanisms like credit ratings for granted, but as Natalia points out, trying to get a loan if you're really poor in a country like India, say, is incredibly difficult. Because if you've always been poor, well, there's very little conventional information available about your creditworthiness. So Natalia and her colleagues have been investigating whether or not it's possible to build a system that uses community or village information to create an informal credit rating system, one based on peer review. Natalia Regal.
The very brief idea is that we go into a community, so we're working in the state of Maharashtra in India, and we recruit respondents to help us be part of our study. And we recruit micro-entrepreneurs. And so what happens is that we first go into the community and do what's called a baseline survey, where we collect a lot of information about micro-entrepreneurs. This data is going to help us validate whether the system that we're using to collect community information actually works. And then what we do is that we gather people into halls or in the privacy of their home, and we ask them to rank micro-entrepreneurs on a series of dimensions. So the types of questions that we ask people are, who, for example, has the greatest business acumen? Who is the person who has the capacity to grow their business? Who is the most hardworking? And so we ask community members to rank micro-entrepreneurs along those dimensions. So we have two ways of ranking. Either we compare them to one another within a group. So in other words, I go to Anthony and I say, Anthony, here's five micro-entrepreneurs who live in your community. Please rank them in order if you think, you know, who's going to be the most productive if we give them a $100 grant. And then what we do is we also ask them to compare the micro-entrepreneurs to the community at large. And so it gives us two different types of metrics, one in which we compare amongst a small group, and then one in which we compare the micro-entrepreneur against the community as a whole.
And it's the informal information then that you get from that process that will then inform whether or not an individual should be given credit by a financial organization. That's the aim, is it?
Exactly. That's exactly the aim. So then what we do is that we give out these $100 grants randomly. And so the idea is that we randomly induce business growth in some businesses and not others. And the reason why we do this is that then we have what we call a control and a treatment group. So we can create what's called a marginal return to the grant, which is to say that we can estimate how productive a business is by giving it to some people and not to others and comparing across the two groups. And so the way that we're going to validate the mechanism is that we're going to see whether people in the community correctly predicted who was able to grow their business the most. So that's going to be the validation mechanism for our study. But this is actually only one piece of the project, because one thing that you might be thinking about is, look, if I, Natalia, lie about myself, it's also possible that people in my community might lie about me. And so a very big piece of our project is that we're thinking really, really carefully about how to get people to tell us the truth about what they know. So what we're doing here is that we're using mechanisms from mechanism design theory. We're using tools from this theory to actually incentivize people to tell us the truth. For example, we're going to be giving people monetary incentives for the reports that they give us. And so the more accurate their reports are, the more money that we pay them. So in this way, we make it what we say incentive compatible for people to tell us the truth about what they know. But we're testing about four or five mechanisms that induce people to tell us the truth and seeing how well they compare to one another and how well they get us to the objective truth of whether somebody is a good entrepreneur or not.
Now, that research is ongoing, but Natalia and her colleagues have completed an initial field study and they have some preliminary results.
So the first thing that we find is that people have a lot of information about one another. They can predict each other's income, their wealth, their ability to repay a loan on time. They can predict profitability of businesses. So people have a wealth of information. The second thing that we learned from our pilot study is that people will lie if they know that the information that they're given might be used to make a decision of allocating something valuable. In other words, if you know that the information that you give me is going to be used to make a grant decision or a loan decision or something of the sort, then people lie. The third thing that we learned is that incentives work really well at getting people to tell us the truth about what they know. And so we find that when we paid people incentives to tell us the truth, in other words, we paid people incentives for the accuracy of their reports got a lot better. So this is really exciting because it means that at least in the pilot work, that people are, A, lying when they can, but that we have potentially found a mechanism to get people to tell us the truth. And so the pilot study was done with pretty low stakes in terms of money. Now, the main study is being done with giving away $100 grants, which is really, really desirable and valuable. So we're hoping to see whether this validation mechanism of paying people incentives to give us the truth is going to continue to hold even when you have greater stakes.
Natalia Regal from MIT in Boston, and we'll endeavour to keep watch on that project and report back to you at a future date. We also heard today from Ian Basson at GiveDirectly, Max Kelly from Deakin University, and Nicole Biskey from Oxfam. Thanks to sound engineer Peter McMurray and my co-producer here at Future Tense, Karin Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
We came, we saw, he died.
Hillary Clinton, 5 years ago, celebrating the fall of Gaddafi. But according to leading British columnist Peter Oborne,
these military interventions by the West in the Middle East recently have failed.
Also, Mark Latham, in praise of Donald Trump's foreign policy. That's Between the Lines, putting Australia in a global context. Join me, Tom Switzer, tonight at 7:30.